Okay, we're going to call the meeting to order. I'm going to announce the substitutes first, and then typically about an hour and a half in, we'll take a 10-minute break. Just want to some reminders also to the members that when it's your time to speak, you may have to wave so that the broadcast can see you. Ask you to identify yourself. Often the minister's light and the corresponding member's light is left on, so that's fine to go back and forth. Do not make adjustments to the chairs. There's water coolers in the back and behind me. There's some glasses and water coolers. And then after I do the substitutes, I will ask for the committee and the substitutes and the caucus employees to introduce themselves, and then we'll go over to the government side. I'll ask the minister to introduce himself along with his staff, and then when we start, the minister gets 15 minutes. So for substituting for Grand Falls, Windsor, Buchans, we have Harbor, Maine, MHA, Helen Conway Ottenheimer. For Lake Melville, we have Carbonear, Trinity Bay de Verde, Minister Crocker. For Mount Pearl North, we have Conception Bay East, Minister Hutton. For Topsail Paradise, we have Bonavista, MHA Party. And for Waterford Valley, we have Minister Lovelace for Fortune Bay, Cape Lahoon. All right, so we'll start on my right with introductions.
Craig Purdy, the MHA for the District of Bonavista.
Hi, Megan Winter, Research and Policy Analyst with the Office of the Official Opposition.
Helen Conway Ottenheimer, MHA for the District of Harbor, Maine.
Elvis Lovelace, MHA for Fortune Bay, Cape Lahoon.
Fred Hutton, MHA for Conception Bay East, Belle Island.
Steve Crocker, MHA for the District of Carbonear, Trinity Bay de Verde.
Eileen Anderson, researcher, GMO.
Paul Pike, Minister, Children, Seniors, and Social Development, Minister responsible for persons with disabilities, and the Minister responsible for the volunteer sector.
Alan Duty, Deputy Minister, Children, Seniors, and Social Development.
Sarah Dow, Assistant Deputy Minister, Corporate Services and Performance Improvement.
Ashlyn Gogan, Assistant Deputy Minister, Prevention and Early Intervention.
Lori Rose, Assistant Deputy Minister of Child and Youth Services.
Tracy English, Assistant Deputy Minister of Policy and Programs.
Dave Martin, Departmental Controller.
Gail St. Croix, Director of Communications.
Margot Pitcher, Executive Assistant to Minister Pike.
Okay, thank you. I now ask the clerk to call the first subhead.
1.1.01 to 1.2.02 inclusive, executive and support services.
So 1.1.01 to 1.2.02 inclusive, executive and support services. Minister Pike.
Yes, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for participating in this year's estimates for Department of Children, Seniors and Social Development. As many of you know, my department consists of 10 lines of business, which includes child protection and care, adoptions, youth services, youth connections, adult protection, persons with disabilities, seniors and aging, poverty reduction, and income support and the community sector. I'd like to take an opportunity before we begin today just to highlight some of my department's key areas of progress since last year. As you know, across the province of Newfoundland and Labrador, our seniors play a very important role in our communities as business owners, members of service organizations, churches, and volunteers. As a matter of fact, I think if you go anywhere in the province of Newfoundland and Labrador and you meet with any service organization or whatever, a lot of them are our seniors. They're very involved in their communities. Our seniors want to live safely. They want to live, they want to enjoy good health and stay active in their communities as they age. Our government is very committed to ensuring what they can. And I'll also say at this point that seniors are very vocal about issues in their community, and they want what's best for their communities. The Seniors Aging Division focuses on helping seniors to remain healthy, active, and engaged citizens in our age-friendly communities and address the province's aging population. Our seniors' health and well-being ensures that the supports and services available to seniors enable them to age well at home. And we all know people who want to age not only in their own homes, but in their own communities, and they want to be part of those communities. Budget 2025 includes $24 million to build on that plan, and that includes $10 million for initiatives under the Seniors' Health and Well-Being Plan. And that includes the Aging Well at Home grant, which is a grant that's available through Newfoundland and Labrador Health Services for low-income seniors to assist with services such as snow clearing and grocery delivery. This is going over very well, by the way, in a lot of our communities. And being the minister responsible for seniors, I get an opportunity to visit many seniors and many seniors' clubs and so on. And they're welcoming these announcements very well. They like what they're seeing. And, you know, of course, they want us to continue to do the great work that we're doing. And we will. And we will. And we all, you know, all of us would agree that seniors are our greatest resource in this province. They've like seniors clubs that I'm not on script, by the way, it's okay. Seniors clubs that I've been into, you know, you look around and I see people there who are accountants, they're teachers, they're, you know, construction workers, carpenters, and so on. You know, they have a great deal, they bring a great deal of wealth to these 50-plus clubs, these seniors organizations. And, you know, they're very well-oiled machines, these seniors clubs. You know, their accounting, their, you know, the activities that they're involved in. I remember one time last year we gave a door to a group, an entrance door. And I asked them what they needed for the door. And they told us the price, and I said, "What about installation?" "Oh no, we do that ourselves. Where about that?" You know, that's the way. You know, that's the good thing about our seniors. They appreciate what you give them, and it's so important that we, as a government, continue to do that. The caregiver benefit is also offered through Newfoundland Labrador Health Services, which provides enhanced support to eligible caregivers of lower-income seniors with complex care needs. And it's important that you, as members here, get out and talk about these programs that government has. I mean, we're all in this together, and we all do great work. And it's important that you, you know, you communicate that to seniors, because when I speak of some of this, a hand will go up, so I didn't know about that. So it's important that we do that. A $500 grant for food and heating for seniors in coastal Labrador communities offered through the Department of Finance. Increased investments for home repair and modifications through Newfoundland and Labrador Housing Corporation to help seniors stay in their homes longer. And we get calls on this all the time. You as members get calls all the time from your constituents talking about wanting to fix a roof or whatever, make the home more accessible, whatever it is. And we're there for that. We're there to help that with that. And I'm sure your offices and your CAs are involved, and they certainly make calls, and it's usually I don't know of anybody that's that hasn't received it unless it's for some reason that's beyond our control. But you know, once these calls come through, we act immediately, and I know Newfoundland Labrador Housing does a great job in administering that. Our expanded 211 navigation services to connect seniors with essential government community programs. And just to let you know as well, we've got our program services, our services and program guides. We're doing more print of those. I don't know how many is in the office now, but there are a fair number. So we'll be getting out to all of your district offices to distribute those so you can get them to seniors groups. Great when you're going to any kind of a seniors function to have a handful of them with you or a box full. So we're going to try to get those in the hands of every senior in the province. And just let our office know, and we'll get them to you. We're also investing $4.7 million for our targeted basic income pilot for people aged 60 to 64 who receive income support as well as supportive services. and or financial assistance through Newfoundland Labrador Health Service Community Sports Program. And I've done some checking on numbers on that, and our numbers are going up. As you remember in the House previously that we talked about that, the numbers were still low, but they are going up. We'll, you know, hopefully in the next little while I'll be able to report more on that. Participants receive benefits in this program. Participants receive benefits comparable with combined federal and provincial benefits for people age 65 and over. So it's making a big difference to those who have actually availed of this. And what that is basically is the federal and provincial benefits combined equals $1,937 per month for a single person and $2,282 per month for a couple. And that's quite, you know, substantial, and it hopefully will help our seniors in that predicament, because I know a lot of people. I didn't know a lot, but I knew a few people that were in that predicament because at age 6 they didn't have work and so on, and they had to wait for the transition. So it's certainly something that, you know, it has been identified as a need for that particular age group. In budget 2025, through strategic investments and target programs, we are ensuring that seniors can live with dignity, independence, and maintain that connection to communities. We're committed to age-friendly, inclusive communities that support health and well-being. We're investing $200,000 through the Seniors Social Inclusion Initiative. This will help seniors in groups for help them with intergenerational programs and services. And we've already, as well, have a handbook out of these, an intergenerational guide that most of the clubs have right now. And that's something that we're hopefully, you know, we're seeing a lot more of that. We're seeing where, and in last year when we looked at CYNs, we asked CYNs, because we increased funding, that they would do more intergenerational things with seniors. So that's being very a great program, and it's working quite well. And when I look at my Facebook, I see these activities on there, and it really does the heart good to see it. We're providing $95,000 for the age-friendly Newfoundland Labrador Communities Program, which helps ensure our seniors can remain healthy, active, and engaged citizens. Reliable transportation is key to staying engaged in the community. Through Newfoundland Labrador Community Transportation Program, we continue to support the development of accessible and inclusive transportation services that will improve mobility within communities and regions. This will help all residents, all our seniors, all our seniors, and especially persons with disability, stay connected and be mobile. And we included $300,000 for this program in budget 2025. And I think the ridership in Clarenville, I don't think I'm off by too much, but it's around 75% to 80% of the ridership are persons with disabilities, or not disabilities, persons with mobile, you know, mobility issues. Yeah, but it's high. It's high. Yes. I remember it being said. It could be less. But, you know, that's a good thing anyways, because all these these buses that are out there, they have accessibility access. Building on the successful bus pass pilot in the St. John's metro area, we have collaborated with the City of Cornerbrook and St. Anthony Resources, Inc. to improve opportunities for affordable busing in those areas. As a result, people on income support, the guaranteed income supplement, and the Youth Department's Youth Services Program will be eligible for free bus passes. And that started in April of 2025. My department has recently launched Bridging Generations, a guide to intergenerational programs. Talked about that, and also the new guide to provincial government programs and services. And this certainly supports our commitment to developing an inclusive, community-oriented, age-friendly province. Disability policy. The Disability Policy Office works closely with persons with disabilities, organizations of and for persons with disabilities, including advocacy groups, and with the federal, provincial, and territorial governments and departments. We established, that was in June of 22, the Accessibility Standards Advisory Board following the enactment of the Accessibility Act in December of 2021. Following the principle of nothing about us without us, this board plays a pivotal role in advising and developing standards, regulations, and policies to identify, prevent, and remove barriers to inclusion. The Government of Newfoundland remains committed to building a more inclusive and accessible province and ensuring equitable opportunities for all to participate in society. This year, we were very pleased to announce the details of a new benefit to support persons with disabilities. Budget 2025 includes a $17.5 million for the Newfoundland and Labrador Disability Benefit. Eligible individuals may receive up to $400 per month in addition to the $1,200 annual contribution to their Registered Disability Savings Plan, very well received and appreciated by persons with disabilities. Budget 2025 also includes $400,000 for the Accessible Vehicle Funding Grant and the Accessible Taxi Program, which supports families and businesses to retrofit or purchase new vehicles to accommodate passengers with wheelchairs or scooters. $94,000 to support ongoing operations of the GoBus transit, accessible transit. $50,000 for the Summer Inclusion Grant, which helps ensure children with disabilities can attend and participate in summer camps. Poverty reduction and income support. We all recognize that these are challenging times that continue to deeply impact individuals and families and those living in poverty across the province, across our country and our world, I guess. Our government is committed to investing in programs and services to support individuals and families impacted by the high cost of living, especially those living in poverty and seniors living on a fixed income. We are investing over $3.3 million to support youth-serving organizations in the province, such as the Community Youth Network, the Boys and Girls Clubs, Big Brothers and Big Sisters. Last year, we were pleased to increase funding to the Community Youth Networks by 5%, as well as provide funding to implement a guaranteed minimum salary for executive directors of the 27 community networks serving youth. And now, we have 34 sites, CYN sites, across this province. Our government's poverty reduction plan has increased support for low-income individuals and families with significant increases to benefits that reduce childhood poverty, support seniors, and keep more money in household budgets.
Okay, thank you, Minister. The member for Bonavista.
You got squeezed for time there, Minister.
Yes, but I know that, it's important that, and I know you were listening quite intently.
Yes, but do you wish to finish?
I think it's important that I outline all of what, I'll certainly you do the Cole's notes on the rest, if that's
Cole's
okay, and just touch on some things, okay?
Okay, continue.
Well, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You're very,
that.
Very welcome.
Budget 2025 in reducing poverty, government is investing $34.5 million to support families with children, including the 300% increase to the Newfoundland Labrador Child Care Benefit, which is administered through the Department of Finance, and the expanding prenatal early childhood nutrition supplement to age 5. An additional $30 million to continue to streamline and improve income support to improve the income support program benefit structure, building on changes over the last 2 years. And a couple of things I really want to say on this one is all qualifying single people now under the age of 30 in receipt of income support are now eligible to receive the same basic benefit rates as recipient in other age groups. So that's new, and it's great. Two separate board and lodging rates based on household type were consolidated into one rate. People boarding with relatives are now eligible to receive the higher monthly rate benefit. So if you're talking to people that are actually experiencing this, they're saying, it's very important for them that they can now contribute to the family and to a lot of them are living with relatives and they can contribute. Those over 65 who qualify for income support now receive an additional $105 per month, regardless of whether they're eligible for federal guaranteed income supplement. Income support recipients who have boarders living with them do not have any of their benefits clawed back. It's making a big difference. In July of 2024, we announced the details of an enhanced funeral benefits. And I don't think I'll go into those today, but we all know how important that piece of legislation was and how important that was for all of us. And also, we have the all-party income committee on basic income that we're working through. We have a document ready for the committee to review. And in that, in preparing a document, of course, we met with a lot of jurisdictions, at the national level and local level. We met with experts in the field, which included people with experience living in poverty. We're also now, I'm just going to give you, all persons deserve the right to exercise legal capacity without discrimination and have the right to make their decisions. And our department now is certainly been looking at the committed to ensuring that these principles of autonomy and support are reflected. In 2024, children, seniors, and social development, justice, public safety, and public engagement conducted public engagement around decision making. Right now, we want to ensure that we are continuing our work on this. We're getting close. I'll give a half a turn. And we want to ensure that people are supported in making decisions, their own decisions. Child welfare, again, something that is very important to our department. CSSD directly provides and connects with families and supports and services that build up on family strengths while addressing safety threats and reducing risks to children. We recognize that where at all possible, it's best to keep children at home and with their families. Therefore, we are focused on exploring options that way. When out-of-home placement is needed, children are placed with next of kin and significant others. Foster families, we deal with foster families, so important. They play a vital role in the lives of children. By the way, there are approximately 545 foster families throughout the province who are dedicated to helping children and youth through complex situations. I think I'll end there thanks for listening, but there's so many things that I wanted to outline today about this department and about the great people that work in the department as well, because I've often said to you and said to everyone, it takes special people to work in my department, and we have them, which is great. So thank you.
Right, the member for Bonavista.
Yep. Thank you, Minister. That was a pretty extensive coverage.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. Seniors are a rich resource. I think you painted that picture.
Yes.
I think we would all agree with that. And I would also agree with the fact that we got to have a greater awareness, because at the office in Bonavista, we'll often find that people would come in and they have a discovery of programs that would be available for them, and yep. Here it is. And like I said, I've been there since 2019, but boy, still, someone new comes in and they're not aware of an existing program. You had stated in your preamble that the guide that was recently put out, which I had 10 copies of and I've circulated out, you did say that there's one for every senior in the province?
That's our intent. That's our intent, put in the hands of every senior in this province.
Okay.
And God willing, we're going to do a roadshow soon. And when we visit 50-plus clubs and other communities,
yep.
We are going to be bringing these books along. For example, I would think if we go to your district, we'll be giving them all to you to distribute, you know, through your office or at that particular event.
Yeah. Good. Thank you. That's our plan. Just to start now, some overarching questions, just for my own clarification.
Yeah.
The write-up in the estimates booklet gives an overview of what the department does. One of the founding components is that you will review policy.
Yes.
I asked the question, how often do you review policy, and what policy would be the longest span without a review? But you weren't expecting that one, but it's just the one.
No. You know, we are reviewing. We're constantly, I guess. It's ongoing. That's what I always say to people. We're always reviewing our policies and so on. And it's so important to us. And, you know, we understand that times change and so on, and that we really need to develop these policies, because most times you're working across more than one department.
Thank you very much.
And you're working across departments to do that. So, you know, like, it involves a fair bit of time, as you know, because you sit on one of those with us, an all-party committee, and looking at the basic income, and you know that, how much it takes. But our general rule is our policies last no longer than 5 years,
okay,
in a sense, without having some changes.
Okay. Yeah. That's what I was wondering.
Okay.
So usually your guardian principle is review within 5 years.
Yep.
Unless something precipitates an earlier review,
yes,
or tweak. You also stated in the preamble as well, Minister, in the booklet, that the department leads initiative to foster poverty reduction and improve well-being, and two noble goals.
Yes.
Is it possible that you have some data that would indicate how successful we are in those two domains, poverty reduction and social well-being?
Yep.
Would we have some data that would indicate that we're making inroads and we're productive with our investments?
And again, I totally agree with your line of questioning, because basically, you know, if we bring in policy, then we have to make sure that what we're doing is working.
Yes.
And our department is gathering that information, because that information is so important as we move forward and to evaluate the policies and procedures that we have. So I've asked all department, and so has my deputy minister, like, to, you know, measure how well we're doing, to ensure that what we're doing is having a benefit on our seniors, our children, you know, those on income support and so on. Like the new initiatives that we have, some are somewhat difficult to measure as well, but we can and we need to. And I think it's going to take us, the changes that we've implemented lately, it's going to take us another year to get some, you know, data on that. But we will provide that, and I hope next year when you're asking the same question and you're there and I'm here, we'll be able to give you that information. But
okay,
our staff is constantly, and our managers and so on, are constantly seeking that type of data.
Good. Thank you. What would be the total expenditure in your department from the negotiated salary increases? Now, we're going to go through each letter, each department head, or whatever you call it, heading, that would be in the estimates. Each one is going to have that component in it. You've got a very large department. I'm just wondering what the total expenditure would be for that 2% negotiated increase.
Okay.
And if you don't have it there, we can move on and just find that and report for the sake of efficiency.
We can get that to you. We'll calculate and get it to you.
Okay. Yeah.
We talked about that a few days ago.
It's broken up by division. But
yeah, and it is broken up by division.
Okay.
Not the whole department.
Not the whole department. But that's fair enough.
Yep.
It'll show up on your desk.
Good. Thank you. As the office of the the Child and Youth Advocate and the Office of the Seniors Advocate, have they made suggestions to you in the most recent past on legislative amendments or policy suggestions for going forward?
We work very closely with you know, the advocate offices, and you know, like it's yeah, like in their reports, we take them very seriously, and we certainly adhere to a lot of what's being said there. And one of the things that we do is we go down through those reports with a goal to make sure that we're meeting the needs of our seniors and of our children and whatever. But yeah, we certainly try and measure. We certainly try and take the reports made by the advocacy offices very seriously. I'm getting a note here now, so hang on.
Oh yeah.
yeah. Basically, what I said, we're working on the recommendations of these reports, and they're very important to me, by the way, because I you know, when these reports come out, we want to make sure that we're working through the report with the advocate. And so we, you know, we'll provide updates on a regular basis. But these are good questions that need to be answered. And I know my department is working diligently on all recommendations made by the advocacy offices.
We're all aware of the tragedy that occurred in the Lapu-Lapu Filipino Festival over in BC.
Yes.
You know, devastating. A tragedy. But I know that the Premier of BC had called a review of impending legislation that they would have. And he referenced the Mental Health Act. And I know we just recently had the Adult Protection Act. And I think what the words he had used was compassionate mandatory care. And they wondered as to whether the individual ought to have been, you know, using a vehicle. I'm just wondering if you had any discussion about a future direction for us in looking at the Adult Protection Act. And I know that it's not in your bailiwick as far as the Mental Health Act, but I'm just wondering as to whether, you know, we're going to look at our policy to look at where we are in this province.
Again, we certainly have our Adult Protection Act under review as we speak. And, yeah, like the things that are happening in our world now and in our own country certainly causing us to reflect, and hopefully we'll be able to bring forward something that will cover off more than that. We, you know, when you start doing a review, as you know, your terms of reference can expand. And
yes.
That's what we will see happening here.
Minister, we're ready now. Remember the Reach for the Top, where I think there was a section where they had some quickies?
Yes.
Well, I'm going to fire some at you now, real
fair enough.
Quick ones. How many staff employed with CSSD? I'm not sure if it's referred to as quickies or not, but it was some segment on that Reach for the Top.
Yeah. I got it all here.
Rapid fire, I think.
Okay. As of March 31st, 2025, CSSD had 1,065 approved positions, with 819 with active incumbents, 718 permanent, and 101 temporary or contractual. We have 246 vacant, including incumbent on leave or no active incumbent in position, 201 permanent, and 45 temporary contractual positions. That's what we have vacant.
Good, good. We mentioned last year, we talked about the social worker, and I think we did in the House as well. Can we update on the social worker personnel that we have?
I should be able to do that off the top of my head, but it's there in the notes.
I think it was the last time you may have mentioned it in the House was 277 social workers and 65 assistants?
As of March 31st, 2025, we had 92 social worker vacancies out of 369 positions within three regions. 24.9% of positions vacant. In the Labrador region was 18 social work vacancies for 57 positions. In Central West, there was 53 social work vacancies for 135 work positions. And in Metro, 21 social work vacancies for 177 social work positions. But one thing that we are doing, as you know, is those social worker assistants. We have 65 of those, and they're making a real difference. For you and I, who have educational backgrounds, they mean the same to a social worker as a student assistant would mean to a teacher. It takes a lot of the workload away from the social worker. It's a big help. But we're still hiring those positions, and we'll continue to until we think it's an appropriate level. But it's unbelievable the difference that it's making. I talked to social workers, and I also talked to some of the people that have taken on those positions, and they really love what they're doing.
Good. We just had housing before, and I really didn't know that they had 17 social workers that they stated that were in the housing element. So many social workers in the province of Newfoundland and Labrador. I can see that you'd have movement.
Yes.
Would you have any idea or an estimate as to the tenure, the length of a social worker in CSSD? Now, I don't know where you would start as far as Gavin, but would you have, I mean, what percentage are pursuing 30-year careers?
Deputy Minister Doody.
I know, thank you. This is a great question. So I think it's important to highlight that over the last 10 to 15 years, the workforce for social workers changed a lot, and there's more demand in the mental health and addictions and within the health system. A good opportunity to acknowledge that child protection social work is by far, I believe, the most demanding and the hardest work to do as a social worker. So we're seeing we can probably go back and do some math and get you the exact data on the length of tenure, but I think our workforce is mixed, where we have, where the work is so hard and we're recruiting, we have a lot of young people coming in. Like just out of the graduating class this year, we're in the process of offering 30 social workers positions across the province. Some people will get into that field and realize this is not the field of work that they want, and they'll leave early. And you'll see some folks that have been long time in the field of child protection who get to a certain point in their career and will say, I just need a change, and they'll leave. But we're also seeing a trend of people coming back. So it's a bit of a mix. So it is very revolving. And I think just to highlight the demand of that work specifically and how hard it is and the great work that group of social workers do, and acknowledging that there is going to be some movement across the system.
Yeah, no, and probably an unfair question. I don't know how I would go about trying to determine that, but I probably have a ballpark as to what we would have. That's all the intent of the question was. What would be the caseload of the average social worker? And if I can qualify that question a little further, we know that we had one-third last year, I think we had one-third of our social workers or the positions that were vacant.
Yeah.
And we did an investment with the social worker assistants. I've often told people in my district when we talked about social workers or they may not have been in a positive light in speaking. All I know is that there were vacancies that had to be filled, which would put a greater workload on the existing social workers. So when you look at the average caseload, probably in the average caseload under a full complement, what you would expect and what we've had with the vacancies.
I'm going to give you the caseload ratio by region, and this is as of September 30th, 2024.
Okay.
So this is actual staff, not positions.
Will we get that as well in the package? Do we have that?
Oh. Yes, it's in the binder.
And if you don't see it there, we'll get it for you, of course, anything we have. Region Metro, we have 151 social workers. We have 2,874 cases, number of cases, but ratio is 1 to 19. One social worker per 19.
Okay. Yeah.
Central West, we have 80 social workers with 2,118 cases, and the ratio is 1 to 26. In Labrador, we have 42 social workers. We have 1,021 cases for the ratio 1 to 24. Provincial total is 273 social workers. Number of cases is 6,013. And our ratio for the province would be 1 to 22. Factor into that, then, the idea of these social worker assistants. You know, like, that's something, again, I think you and I had a conversation about
yes,
that.
Yes, we did.
And we both agreed that that's something that we need to be looking more towards.
Yep.
The plan ratio, by the way, our plan ratio, which is what we're looking at, where we're heading for, is a provincial ratio of 1 to 20.
Okay.
Okay.
I would think that would be good for that section.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Okay, I ask the clerk to recall the subject.
1.1.01 to 1.2.02 inclusive, executive and support services.
Shall 1.1.01 to 1.2.02 inclusive, executive and support services carry? All those in favor? All those against? Carried. I ask the clerk to call the next subhead.
2.1.01 child and youth services.
2.1.01 child and youth services. Member for Bonavista.
How many children are in CYS care currently? And maybe as a follow-up of that, because I'm sure you got it broken down, how many would be in the level four category?
The number of children and youth in care reached a high in 2016 of 1,035 children and youth. So that was in December. The numbers have been declining since that time. 925 in care as of September 30th, which is 11% increase.
Decrease.
How many of those?
And the number in level four?
Yeah.
225. That's an increase in
previous years. And how would that compare, Minister? Yeah. How would that compare to previous?
Well, that is an increase.
Previous years. That's an increase.
Yes.
Over previous
years.
We're
finding an increase there in those numbers, which of course has an impact upon on the workload of and the number of positions that we have.
Are you, do you have any experiences with the Canadian Tire Jumpstart Foundation?
I do, yep.
Remember,
yes.
I think that was a wonderful program that served a lot of children, of which that we may have on our caseload. I don't think we participate in that now financially in that program, but when we did, I know that as an administrator in Clarenville, we reached a whole lot of children through that program. I just say that if we're not... Well, we're not, but I'm an advocate for that program, knowing what it did in reaching youth.
Mm. Yeah. Again, that's under TCAR.
Okay, yeah.
But I will agree with you on that, because being principals of schools would have known that what a difference that made in the lives of a lot of children when it came to playing hockey and sports and other
100%.
Recreation activities.
Yeah. There were 4,900 children receiving, I think, receiving child support payments. I remember I presented a petition in the House on a couple of occasions. There's a regulation. I know that's not your area, but your area is children. So I'm just going to throw this out to you, and I think you listened intently with that petition, and we talked about it after.
Yep.
I'm familiar with several of those child support payments that don't come at the start of the month. and the child with the often the single mother has received no income because the payment hasn't come. And sometimes, whether it was orchestrated or not, it came in small increments because the understanding was they got 30 days to pay it, and whether through necessity or whether through, ill intent, it was trickled in. So I know the payment rate is good, but I know they have that regulation of 30 days. In that meantime, the single mother with the child or children can't pay their rent on time at the first of the month because it's not dependable, that child support payment coming in. And I would assume that it would be an insecure food insecurity issue, but you don't have that money at the start of the month. The question posed was, why don't we pay the child support payment and garner the funds from the person who is paying it? If the payment is not a problem, why do we have the trickling in over system? And again, I state, when we're looking at child and youth services and serving the children to make sure that these situations don't occur, then I would think that's probably something the department can look into. If you see merit in it, it's probably one that you may be able to advocate for. But at least it's something I think we need to look into. And I don't know how widespread that is, but I know that I've got three that I know of that every now and then they'll send me what the payment comes in at the start of the month.
I know.
$24, where it should be $590, but 30 comes in, and then the way it goes.
If I might just respond to that. This is Department of Justice.
Yes, I realize that.
You and I did have the conversation, and from that, I did have a conversation with some of my colleagues about that. And we can certainly, I'm going to certainly bring this back again to my colleagues and to have a chat about it again.
Yep.
There's no need for that to be happening. And we're going to take it under consideration and work on that. But when you made that point to me, it was the first time I heard of it, but I could see how it can be very, very problematic.
Yes. Yep. Thank you. How many Indigenous children are currently in the CYS care?
We're using the same one. Okay. Is it the provincial total? Is it just the provincial total? We'll just do the provincial total.
Yes.
The provincial total is 300. 300.
300.
Yes.
And I think that was the same as what it was last year. Generally, so
yeah.
we're hovering around 300.
Yeah. Probably. Well, if you want, I could go totals. I could go central, west, or 70.
No, I think that's fine, Minister. Thank you for that.
Okay.
For the last number of years, the department had to go to the government for the contingency fund, and you know that the CBC did an article on that with the $20 million. They're working with you as a department. It comes down to those level four children that we have in the group homes in our province as the expenditure. I would almost contend this, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, as the population, the school population in Newfoundland and Labrador declines, we're at the same time probably seeing an increase in the children with complex needs in our province. And I would say that challenges us, I know, and I'd be interested in a little point later as to what initiatives we're doing to address that issue. And, we'll engage in that. So of that, what measures would the department have taken or are taking or pursuing to look at reducing the amount of that contingency fund, but ultimately providing the care that's needed.
Yep. Okay. Alan's going to respond.
Deputy Minister Doody.
Yes. Yep. First, thanks for the question. So it really is a complex space when we talk about children coming into care. So we are certainly seeing a spike in the number of complexities that those children are have been exposed to. I think from a trauma perspective, you think there's trauma in the home, which starts the process for removal. And the removal itself is also traumatic for children.
Yes.
And so there are a bunch of initiatives that are ongoing so we're in the process of reviewing our foster family program, because if we have more foster homes, we can place children in foster homes earlier, which gives them a more stable environment. So about growing that. First and foremost, we try to place with family, so with through the kinship program. And then when we can't find suitable placements, that's when they end up in the in the group home system. So it's an ongoing assessment of children and children's needs and how we move them. So the cost of those programs the group home programs are pretty set, and it's the individualized living arrangements where we put all the wraparound supports in and in certain homes for certain children that actually drives the cost up. So, I mean, ultimately, it is a very complex from a continuum perspective, and there's no one thing that we can do to solve that. It is a whole bunch of items.
Yeah.
One of the other activities of the department as well is we're doing prevention. So when CSSD becomes aware of a family that's in distress, we're actually working with families to try to rectify the issues within the home to keep the child in the home or only have them out for a short period of time. So there's also those programs as well. So it is complex across the continuum. And of course, the cost overall is being impacted by just even the changes in cost of living. So the service providers are feeling the cost of living changes as well, and that gets reflected back in the budget. So I guess there's several initiatives across the department, but it's the one thing we look at. I would say we discuss it on a daily basis on the best. But as keepers of the public purse, we need to be responsible for the money. But really, what we really focus on is outcomes. So how do we need to change the system to get the best outcomes for children? And that's what drives the work.
Good. Back in my schooling time, we had community policing come in, and they came in and they spent time in the school, you know, creating relationships with the children. We talk very highly of that in the education system and thought that, boy, that was an investment into the future, you know, in that relationship bonding with these young children and with the police force. I wonder about the social worker program. So we had one-third of our social workers that were absent. So if we had one-third that was out, the two-thirds that were remaining at an increased caseload, I would assume, probably with a great degree of certainty, that the most complex case got the bulk of the time from the social worker, which would be the obvious, no different in our school system. Can we look at the system in saying that we did not really do a good job on the preventative initiatives in some of these not so complex cases that you can't intervene because we never had time to do so? But if we had done so, we might have curbed that path to the level 4 or level 4 complex case.
Yes.
Would you agree with that scenario?
Well,
I can't think what else it could be, why the numbers would be, and I know there's a myriad of things that would be in our society now that might contribute as well, but nevertheless, early intervention.
Yeah, as you were speaking, I certainly realized that, you know, we need more cross-departmental work on this issue, and we are now in the process of working with health and education to look at this situation. It's something that certainly we recognize in schools We pick it up very early, and we realize that, but we also got to bring in the support as well. And you and I know firsthand about that. I keep referring to you and I because we're both educators. Yeah. And but we are doing that. We you know, you got to realize that we got to involve other departments, and we do that a lot anyways on yeah. other issues. But that's something that we're certainly working on that now. You're ahead of your time.
I know that I think seen but not heard, the 2019 report by the Child and Youth Advocate had mentioned about to make sure that those people that are working directly with these children have a minimum qualification.
Yes.
That makes good sense.
Yes.
And we'll know from our schooling days that if we had a child with some exceptionality in the school, yes. then we wanted our IRT teacher to be on the front lines working, which is the most skilled that would be to present. And then in 2021, when we had the youth advocate as well, a special kind of care, she profiled this young child which had global developmental delay. And when she was in this group home, I think the report stated that she had 75 different staff members and was very critical of the interactions of the staff members with the child because the staff members, to some proportion, never had the training to deal with the youth. Now, I would say, in reading that, that meant that that wasn't right in trying to curb what we wanted to facilitate in these youth. The happy part of the story was, I think she continues on, the advocate, to say, well, moved out and got specific care by trained people outside the group home. Yeah. And I would hope that from that point in time to now in 2025,
yeah.
she's still progressing well.
Yes.
So when I heard a social worker in my district ask me one time and talked about parent coaching. And this is in the same vein as what I just mentioned to you. So she talked about parent coaching. And I asked her, who does the parent coaching? Well, she said, we never had a lot of time because of the demand to do the parent coaching. And what they do is they would farm it out, and I say farm it out in a respectful way, but he would farm it out to the home care agency, and those workers at the home care agency would go in to do parent coaching. So, of course, my next question was, what qualifications do they have? And the social worker was up front and said, it's usually hit or miss. You know, you've got some that do it quite well, others don't. I don't know. I think that still practice is still going on. I know sometimes they have trouble making and finding people to go in for the parent coaching, but you can see the commonality. If we don't have the people with the expertise, the social worker assistants, I would assume would, they can go right into those parent coaching, I would think, with the skill set that we've provided for them. But I fail to see on the home care workers scale how they would be going in to do the parent coaching in some of the cases. That's and I found that to be a little startling. So I throw that out when we're looking at curbing and reaching children and parents in their own home when they're young and making sure that we've got the most qualified personnel that are going in, because we got to make sure that we curb this path that we find that we would be into now. So, Minister, I'll just leave that. If you've got any comment on that.
Yeah. Yes, I do. I'd like to make a couple of comments.
Yeah.
First of all, we have training standards in place, and that's required as part of the licensing process in group homes and so on, as well for group homes. We provide coaching through the behavior management specialists. We don't use our home care workers to do anything. Our home care workers, if they're in with a family, are only there to help prepare meals and that sort of thing. They don't do any coaching. So that, I hope that answers part of what you comment or explain some of. But the other thing I want, you mentioned the Office of Child and Youth Advocate. And so the Office of Child and Youth Advocate has issued, and you talk about recommendations and what they've said and so on. They've issued a total of 179 recommendations specific to CSSD. Of these 179, 79 are implemented, 20% are partially implemented, and 1% are not considered as already implemented. The four recommendations outlined by a long wait for change. These are included in these statistics. The CSD is responsible for leading these recommendations in collaboration with the Office of Indigenous Affairs and Reconciliation. There are 10 investigative reports released with recommendations for the department, which have outstanding recommendations in the most recent status update.
Okay. Thank you. When was the last legislative review of the legislation in your department? And I say we Adult Protection Act. I know we had that one, but it wasn't. It was prior to 2019, unless I missed it.
Yep. Okay.
Tracy English. So the Adult Protection Act was last reviewed in 2022.
Yes.
The Adoptions Act was last reviewed in 2022, and the Child, Youth, and Families Act is actually under statutory review right now.
Okay. When was the last time that one was amended?
So we're this, it's a 5-year review period.
Oh, that's
so
okay. We're on the cycle now.
This, yeah.
Okay, good. Thank you very much, Minister. Would you agree if somebody made the comment that in today's society, we're seeing a spike in drug usage, drug traffic, domestic violence? And I know from your position now with the in your department, would you agree with that narrative? That's
I don't have the stats here.
No.
So I can get them for you.
No, you don't need the stats. I'm just wondering if you would think that was the case, because that would be part of a problem that we would have with the complexity of the children that we serve and where we find ourselves and the hardships that the department may face.
You know, I'd like to answer your question, but I don't have the data.
No, no, that's fine.
So if that's okay, but I mean, if we have data that you want, we'll certainly get it for you.
Yeah. The CBC article stated that the cost for one of the children that would be in these homes would be $400,000 each. Would that be correct?
Deputy Minister Doody.
It varies, so the cost, depending on the complexity of needs and what's required. So I don't know specifically what they were quoting, but their an individualized living arrangement would certainly be in that type of ballpark of the cost.
And most of those group homes would be via private companies. We do not have ownership of a group home, do we, as a province?
Deputy Minister Doody.
Yeah, so there's non-for-profits and also private operating those facilities.
Is it possible to know how many of these particular youth are involved with the justice system as a rough percentage?
Yes. Sorry, are you referring to the children that are in care or in
I was thinking
in the,
now
in the corrections program.
Corrections to group home.
Corrections.
Yeah.
Tracy English.
So there are, as of September 2024, there were 99 youth involved in community youth corrections program and 40 involved in extrajudicial sanctions. But that wouldn't, those, they wouldn't necessarily be in group homes or in
ILAs.
There's a number of kids who are involved in youth corrections.
Will you mind repeating those numbers? I apologize on that.
No, that's great. It's 99 youth involved in community youth corrections and 40 involved in extrajudicial sanctions for a total of 139.
Okay. Thank you. You had mentioned about the recommendations that were accepted, you know, things that we've moved on for, we checked it off, that we've got it. You had mentioned one of the recommendations that were in the Auditor General's report on May 2024 that was listed as achieved would be the department should consider reassessing kinship homes that were approved under the previous child welfare allowance program, and that is what you're doing now, isn't it?
Correct.
That's what we're looking at, right? This one here, and I'll just a couple of them. The department's social workers should visit with children in care and placement resources once a month in accordance with the protection and in care policy and procedure manual. The results of these visits should be documented in a timely manner.
That's a requirement.
That's
yes.
Being, even with the shortage of social workers, we're still achieving that.
Yes.
Within the month.
Yes.
And a protection and in-care policy and procedure manual, that's constantly being reviewed.
Yes, for sure.
How many families receive the Newfoundland and Labrador child benefit? You can get that to me. If you haven't got it now,
that's a finance question because they administer that.
Okay, but
we can get it. We can get it.
Okay. Yep. And I'd also like, Minister, if possible, the prenatal early childhood nutrition supplement. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we may have something. Do we have numbers on that? Uh, 500 families receiving that now.
500 families. Is that the prenatal early childhood nutrition supplement?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, 500. Okay. One last one in this section. I know in the... I've heard from a lot of school officials that sometimes, under the confidentiality, they're not quite familiar with the children of whom that would be in care or come to their schools that under the care of a social worker or working with a social worker. And I understand you got limitations in doing that. But I got to believe sometimes when I walk away that it is not the best care for the child if there's not collaboration between the guidance counselor at the school of which the child is attending and the social worker. And I know that might be a fine line in between, but from reports I've heard is that lots of times they come in and they know that the child, there's something was up, but they're not informed what is up. And why they... on a needs basis would be someone is making the determination that sometimes they can intervene in, as a guidance counselor, as a school, to bring support to the child or to the issue that would be at hand. And I don't know where the policy is on that. Maybe someone can speak to what that policy would be?
I know where you're coming from, but this is, you know, this is part of our ongoing work. We've had a lot of discussions about this, and it's part of our ongoing work. Between education, CSSD, health community services, and so on. And it's important, and we're starting to see more information sharing, and that's what we're working towards. So that would hopefully take care of what you're talking about, because I know I've been there, and, you know, in my previous life, and I know what this is, what it needs. And information sharing is certainly something that's very important. Yeah. And like I say, it's something that we've initiated, we've started, and it's working quite well, or it's beginning to work quite well, I should say.
Yeah, good. Thank you. Have you made representation to anybody to look at the thresholds for the child benefit? It's been the same for years, and we know where it is, and I'm fully respectful of everything costs money, and there's only so many resources. I know that, but I'm just wondering. I know some people are being missed with such a low threshold as what we have.
Yeah. In my current role as Minister of CSSD and responsible for other areas as well, we get a lot of questions about thresholds, and it's something that I'm seeing more and more. When I go, especially when I go to a lot of seniors events, but again, all our thresholds are now under review, and with a hope to making some changes. As you know, they're required, they're needed, and it's not a week goes by that I don't get a question on thresholds, and it's something that we are taking very seriously and working on.
I think that will conclude this session. For this section, Madam Chair.
.1.01 Child and Youth Services.
Okay, we shall resume. I will ask the clerk to call the next subhead.
3.1.01 to 3.1.03 inclusive, policy and programs.
3.1.01 to 3.1.03 inclusive, policy and programs. Member for Harbor, Maine.
Thank you, Chair. And, Minister, I'd like to just ask some general questions, first of all. And this would be regarding the under the Disability Policy Office 3.102. But these are some general questions. First of all, with respect to the Accessibility Standards Advisory Board, just want to ask a few questions about that, if I may. So right now, could you just please describe the composition of the board?
Okay. The board composition. We got that there. Okay.
Tracy English.
Tracy.
I don't have the numbers in front of me right now as to how we've composed the board. We have done some active recruitment for additional members, but the board did meet four times in 2024-25 as required by the legislation. So I think when we were here last year, we talked about how we were down a chair and a vice chair, and our meetings had kind of stalled a bit as a result of that.
Yep.
So we're now back up to the point where we've had our full complement of meetings. We've also constituted our accessibility standards committees, and they've met six times so far.
Okay, thank you. So if I recall from questions I asked last year, so the board had met four times.
Yeah.
I believe it was twice in person and
twice
virtually. So you're saying that this past year they've met four times as well, pursuant to what's required under the Act. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. And you also mentioned with respect to the chair and the vice chair last year, you were down of chair and vice chair, and that you were recruiting. So is there now a chair and a vice chair of the board?
I can answer that, Minister. Tracy English is currently a vice chair of the board, and we're in the process of appointing our chair. So the vice chair can act on the chair's behalf.
Okay. And so could you just explain again how many are on the board?
I don't have the number in front of me, but I can get it.
Okay, if you could just provide.
It's on the Independent Appointments Commission's website.
Okay, perfect.
But I don't have the numbers right in front of me.
Perfect. And so just with respect to the board, so as the minister in his opening comments had indicated, the Accessibility Act had come into force, or it became law, December of 2021, and as well, the board was established then, I believe you stated it was in December of 2022. So I want to ask about the standards, because I know that currently the board was basically mandated to create standards, and that from what I heard last year, there were two standards that were established, but are there any draft standards? Because I just questioning, you know, what has actually been produced, you know, as a result in terms of the standards. What can we actually see? You know, you're saying that there have been meetings, a number of meetings in the past year, four meetings. So what has been produced in concrete terms in terms of the standards that were mentioned last year? And I believe those standards were in regards to customer service and communications.
Yeah, I remember being at the last meeting, and I usually drop in prior to the meetings to have a chat with the board. They don't have their draft standards ready yet, but they're working on them. So we will have more. I think at the next meeting or the following meeting, we should be able to provide information on those. The two that we were working on, I'm very pleased with the progress made there. But, you know, again, the draft standards will be available soon. I can't remember all of the discussion on that, but I do know that the committee is quite motivated and enthusiastic about getting moving on the other standards. And so I'm anticipating that the next meeting we might be able to have something then.
Okay, thank you, Minister. Because the reason I'm asking is because, you know, as the minister, you have certain expectations of the board, although they set their own agenda and they are independent, independent board of government. You have asked them to establish priority standards, which they haven't actually drafted them yet, but I want to just find out if this is a correct assumption to make, that there cannot be any recommendations to the minister until that first step of establishing the standards has been done. Is that correct?
Yes. According to the Accessibility Act, the public bodies are required to prepare an accessibility plan that will address the prevention, identification, and removal barriers in all policies, programs, and services. Children, seniors, and social development is currently finalizing the first annual report for the 2024 indicators, which will be released in the coming weeks, and we'll have some things included in that. But I got to let you know, the Disability Policy Office in my department, We offer education and guidance to public bodies in the development and implementation of these plans, and that's important that I mention that now, because you know a lot of the accessibility plans have to comply with the Accessibility Act, and our policy office does a good job in making sure that they are following all of the recommendations that we have.
Thank you, Minister. And I just want to make one comment, though, about what I referenced with respect to the fact that, you know, there are no draft standards yet. Therefore, you know, we're not seeing any recommendations. And I, as critic for persons with disabilities,
yes,
are hearing from people in the disability community who are concerned that, you know, if we have an act which came into force several years ago, and yet, you know, we don't have draft standards. I'm being questioned and asked about whether, you know, the act right now is meaningless in a sense, in that it's a paper tiger. So I just wonder what your comments would be about that description or that characterization.
Yeah. The board basically is, they're developing and doing research and developing the standards, and you know we'll have a we have our first 5-year review coming up on that in 2026, and we're hoping to be much further along by then. And as you know, we have had some difficulties with the attendance and with the board makeup itself, but right now I think we're on track, and it'll be something that we'll be looking to make sure that we move this along, especially in the coming months.
Thank you, Minister. Now, the other area I would like to ask you a question on is with respect to the disabilities advocate. Has any work been done on the creation of a disabilities advocate?
Yes. In 2023, as you know, Justice Robert Fowler completed his review of statutory offices. And in that review, he recommended the focus of the Office of the Seniors Advocate include persons with disabilities. We are taking this recommendation. We haven't made any decision, but we're taking this recommendation under consideration prior to any decisions being made with respect to the advocate positions. I believe it's important here to know that community organizations and groups also play an important role in the advocacy in the province. Staff have been in ongoing engagement with these disability organizations, and we welcome the opportunities to discuss that any issues that are important. The Accessibility Standards Advisory Board provides advice and recommendations to my department regarding accessibility standards and practices. And we think that there's a number of things that we need to do to support the community of and for persons with disabilities. So I guess the best I can say now is that it is under review. We don't have any decision made on how we're going there. But we are talking to people in the community of and for persons with disabilities.
Thank you, Minister. Now, when I look at the history, ever since I've been the persons with disabilities critic or shadow minister, I've asked the question back with respect to the disability advocate. And for example, back in April of 2023, when I asked about the disability advocate, I was told that things were on hold at that time. And then last year, in April 2024, I asked about the disability advocate and the progress of that. And again, I was told that the government is currently reviewing the report. That was last year. And it was that review that you were waiting prior to any decisions that are going to be made with respect to the disability advocate depended upon your review of the statutory offices of the House of Assembly by Justice Fowler. Now, that was completed, Minister, in October of 2023. That was 21 months ago. So the review has been going on since then. So I think it's reasonable to ask the question on behalf of the disability community. You know, this report, you've had it in your hands for 21 months, and the people would like to know when they can expect a decision with respect to the disability advocate.
I guess to answer your question, I've been part of many discussions, especially in the last few months. It's something that's really we've highlighted as something we need to give priority to, and we are. We have some work left to do with that, but we hope to have something moving soon. And I get it. I get what you're saying, too, okay, because I get it, too. And we've had discussions with staff. Ellen and I have had numerous discussions on it. And, you know, the recommendations that were put forward by Justice Fowler on that, you know, that can be problematic in a number of ways, and it can work in a number of ways. And we're just trying to do the right thing here and make the right decision. And again, I will say to you that we will get on this, we'll stay on this until we get something done, and we'll try to do that soon, because like you, I'm hearing it all the time.
Thank you, Minister. And with respect to the disability community, there's another issue with respect to the disability advocate, and that I'm hearing, and it is clear that they are not content with having the seniors advocate office combined or merged with persons with disabilities, a disability advocate. So, you know, and that was what is proposed by the structural review of the statutory offices of the House of Assembly. That has been proposed, and there is concern about that. Combining the advocate, disability advocate with the seniors office, disability office, will be detrimentally affect the persons with disabilities, and the important unique issues that persons with disabilities face. So I would like to know, Minister, what is your response to that?
I guess the best response I can make at this point in time is that we are listening, and we're listening to all viewpoints around us, and we're also meeting, you know, talking to various groups and so on. And I can tell you that personally, as minister, I've been trying to move this file along as quick as I can. And we're hoping to be able to get something out as soon as possible. I understand the frustration. I understand I've talked to persons with disabilities on this. I've talked to seniors about this as well. On that recommendation, and I think it's time that we looked at it very seriously, and I'll do my utmost to move this along as quickly as possible and get this done one way or the other.
Thank you, Minister. So the time issue and the necessity of dealing with this soon is good to hear that you recognize that, and as well,
yes,
you recognize and acknowledge the fears and concerns of persons with disabilities.
We're taking all that into account.
That with the merging of these yes, two important, very important advocates. Thank you. With respect to, I'll move now to salaries. Can you, Minister, outline what positions were vacant to give a salary savings?
So which line was that?
That was under 3.102, Disability Policy Office, under salaries, 01
okay.
Salaries.
Savings from the 24-25 budget that was vacancies during the year in the department program coordinator position.
Okay, thank you. And with respect to, this is the final area that I'd like to explore, and that's with respect to grants and subsidies. I wonder if you could give a list of where this funding went, and last year more than budgeted was given out. Why hasn't the number for this year been increased to reflect that? That's under grants and subsidies. So if you could give a list of where this funding went, first of all, and then explain that last year there had been more than budgeted was given out, and why hasn't the number for this year been increased to reflect that?
Okay.
And that those are my questions.
I'll answer both.
Thank
you. I'll keep them separate. So.
Okay.
First of all, grant programs. Accessible vehicle grants for 24-25 was... The 520,000.
This was the budget. This is what we
Yeah. Yeah. We in the budget was 350, and we spent 520, which is a good thing. Accessible taxi grants, we budgeted 50,000, and we spent 50,000. Inclusion grants, 75,000. We spent 75,000. Capacity grants, 250,000. We spent 250,000. Coalition of Persons with Disabilities core funding. We budgeted 34,000. We spent 34,000. Paratransit grant, 94.5. We spent 94.5. Summer camp inclusion grants, 50,000. We spent 50,000. So the increase, the $170,000 increase, mm-hmm. Came in 24-25 as a result of increased need and accessibility, accessible vehicle funding grants, with savings reallocated from seniors and aging division reallocated to cover that.
Thank you, Minister. That's very helpful. Could you, I do have one final question. Do you, when I look at the document that was the handout in the communications package in budget 2025, and there's like a listing under accessible and inclusive communities. There's a listing of the funding investments that were made, and there's a reference to, for this year, budget 2025, $300,000 for the community transportation program, which has funded more than 20 projects. Now, when I look at last year, I see that there's a $325,000 for inclusion grants, which were 75,000 inclusion grants and capacity grants 250,000. That's 325. I just want to make sure I understand this. So is that what we're talking about? When we look at community transportation program that was referenced in your handout, is that the same thing as the $325,000 last year in the budget for inclusion grants of 75 and capacity grants 250,000? That comes to a total of 325. Are you following me? I just want to see. You know, I just want to see. I want that clarified because it doesn't. It's not clear to me.
Yeah, I know where you come from on that. And like the Newfoundland and Labrador community transportation grants, we budgeted 300,000, but we only spent 130,000. That was that was application based, right? So that's the number of applications we had. But now we've been pushing this a lot. Okay, and we're trying to get more information out because we believe in the Newfoundland and Labrador Community Transportation Program, and the fact that we can offer grants to communities to build transportation for seniors and persons with disabilities in their communities. Was through this grant as well? We provided monies for studies. Yeah, the accessibility grant, yep. So we also gave out monies, not under this one, but under accessibility grants for communities to get together to see if they could probably support busing in their community or...
That's the right grant.
That's the right grant, yeah, okay. That is the right grant. So we gave out a number of communities last year, $10,000 to study that. And it's something that we're promoting when we go out and speak. I always end with this particular program because it's so important that, and what we're trying to do is we provide a grant for them to do the study, to hire someone to do the study or whatever they want, and they come back whatever is needed to carry this out, if the town body and if the Lions Club body and things like that, and see if we could support transportation in that community. So it's gaining momentum as we go. We get more inquiries now, and I expect a bigger uptake this year.
Is that okay?
Yep, that was going to be my final question. Are you seeing an uptake in
We're hoping.
Yes?
I think we will because the 50-plus clubs that I speak to and seniors groups, we're getting a fair number of inquiries about that. And but the thing is if you're talking to your, say, a local group, it's important that the town council is probably one of the, you know, the councils in those towns are one of the biggest supporters that they can get, because even though the community will have a brand new bus, okay, and it'll be run by volunteers and so on, and it'll be an accessible bus with ramps attached and so on, you know, for tar changes and oil changes and things like that, if the towns are buying in, a lot of towns have their own garages, their own maintenance people and so on, and that's what we're finding works the best. As a matter of fact, Holyrood is in the process of doing an assessment.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Yeah. No, that completes my questions. Thank you very much, Minister and staff.
Okay, seeing no further questions.
Yes.
Do you have a question?
Yes.
Okay, Member for Bonavista.
Yeah. We're looking at now the 3.101, that's the seniors and aging. The Health Accord stated that Newfoundland and Labrador is one of the few provinces without legislation specific to long-term care or care of the elderly. A modern legislative framework, act and regulations is also needed for home care, supportive housing for seniors, personal care homes, and long-term care facilities. An update on the status of that legislation?
Love the bill provided, but that's covered in the Department of Health.
Okay.
Okay. But I hear you. You know, it's the Department of Health.
So even though it's we're dealing with the clientele that you got a vested interest in, but that would come under health?
Yes.
Okay. Looking at the child welfare, you mentioned that you're going to be looking at for the independent living or the group homes, the foster care, and I think you might have mentioned the kinship a little closer with the foster care. I'm not sure if you're looking at the family justice system or not, and I know that that's the Department of Justice. But the Department of Justice are dealing with the children in care. And the question would be, is that I've had two lawyers in the area speak out, reference out on the what they looked at to be concerning elements about the children and the family justice system. And in fact, I'll just give you a little quote from one of these lawyers who got over 10 years in the family court system. It said, "The entire family law system needs to be torn down and rebuilt because it works for nobody. I have constituents who come to my office. I've been directly involved with some of which children have been involved with, and I tend to agree with the lawyer that would be. I'm just wondering if you as a department representing the children that would be in youth and their welfare, have there been concerns brought to your attention about the family justice system that you may be in consultation with the Department of Justice on?"
Deputy Minister Doody.
Yeah, so I just want to make sure that we're clear, first of all, that the family justice system and the youth that are involved with justice system may not necessarily be under the purview of CSSD.
No.
It's only children that would be in care if they're involved with the justice system that CSSD would have involvement.
Yep.
So, you know, we're the safety net for families and children when it comes to that perspective. The other item is that we meet with, there's already a working group that meets with justice on a regular basis about items dealing with the court. and how to expedite things through the family court.
Yeah.
But again, that purview strictly resides within the Department of Justice and Public Safety.
My point in raising that, if I hearken back to before, when we look at the identification and the growing list of complex cases, and I think we probably both agreed that we need to get in on the ground floor, preventative, get in early. If we know that any situations out there with children in Newfoundland and Labrador that are involved, that you know that there are pitfalls as a result of it, then that's probably where we should get involved before it comes into you to know that we're being preventative. And I know it can be another department. All I'm saying is that they're all our children. And if we know that there are situations brought that in this system that need to be tweaked, then I would think that even though it might not come under your bailiwick, then you certainly got a vested interest to try to curb that it certainly doesn't come to your department.
So as the minister had stated earlier, that there's ongoing effort between Department of Children, Senior and Social Development, Department of Health and Community Services, and the Department of Education on trying to ensure that there's horizontal look across and how we have intervention at the earliest point in time for families and children.
Good. Thank you.
To add to that, too, is that the child protection social workers become involved at a point when there's a need. The children can't be kept home, in the home, and they're not safe in their own home. And that's when we become involved in those situations. When we become involved in families, as you know, our main focus is to keep the child in the home with the provision of services and supports that we can provide to our social workers. That's our main focus here.
And again, just on the last point, I know that we're looking at the well-being and the mental health of those children, that we want to make sure that their path is as linear to health, healthy adulthood as possible. And if we find that all of a sudden we've got separation of a parent that goes on for a year and a half as a result of a justice system that don't enact court orders, then I would think it's quite possible that that child may develop some behaviors manifest itself that could be problematic, whether for the K-12 system, which I know this, even though the children attend, or for your department.
Yeah,
that's the
just
only
one
point.
One other thing,
on
too. As of September 30th, 2024, we had 2,175 families receiving supports under our protective intervention program.
2,500?
2,175 families. It's quite large.
Yeah. On the foster care program, and I just bring this to your attention now from cases that I'm familiar with. That's all. I reached out to the department, and I think one of your officials reached out to the foster mom. At a conversation, the foster mom had some concerns about the regulations that would be within the care. And I understand that there's a variety and there's reasons for everything. But I know that even after the conversation that she had, that she was very appreciative of, she had some concerns about the foster care program and the children. The genesis of which she states, of which the conversation was that the bottom line / policy is that family connection is best regardless of what havoc it leaves in its wake. In other words, the family connection's got to be maintained regardless of whether it is a court order that doesn't provide any, for one of the parents with the child, there's no custody, the courts rule against it, but still there had to be the linkages, even when the children didn't wish it, but it had to occur. And I think she looked at the turmoil within the children and just questioned as to what the regulations and the policy would be. And that's beyond me. I'm no social worker. I just know that I know this lady in particular, and she's a class act, and I respect of what her viewpoints would be and a concern. And if I may, before you address, and I know that one became public recently, and that I won't mention any, and the recent public was another foster mother, of which the had stated publicly that she was a working mom And the understanding was that the children that were in her care, there was going to be remuneration and support with getting the kids to and from the school and to and from various appointments that they would have. Again, because apparently she had stated that she had used up all her sick leave and everything was used up. Eventually, the children were removed from that foster care and were put into one of the homes that we referenced, that we're talking about, the group homes. Tragedy struck one of them. One remains there. And you're probably familiar with the situation that I had heard when I was driving. That was concerning. But I know that you can't speak particular cases. I know that because there are other variables that I'm not aware of and the listeners are not aware of that we hear, and I respect that. But the only thing, when I go back to my initial, my resident, the foster mom in my district, I can vouch for her. And I know that the situation she said and what she explained, what was being impressed upon and what had to happen, I, without any background, would disagree with it as well. And if the family connection got to occur without any prohibitions or any restrictions, that is concerning. And keep in mind, in the school, we had a guidance counselor in our school, and the guidance counselor would listen to the children, the child, and understand what their concerns were, and we would try to mitigate those concerns as a school system. That's the way it worked. But according to the foster mom, that's not what works. And she contends that the children don't have a voice. And she don't know when that would occur, that the children would have a voice. Now, that's a lot to digest. I just throw that out, and I know you're doing analysis of the foster care. And I do believe that is a good positive direction, is having more foster homes for the children that we want to provide the ultimate care for. And I do go back to the point that early intervention is sometimes the best strategy, and resourcing it can be problematic. I totally understand. But early intervention, I think, is very significant.
So first of all, thank you for your comments. And as you said, there's no way to speak specifics about cases. The literature will tell you, and the clinicians will tell you, that connection with family is really important to the development of the child. So every case is different, depending, but having that linkage back to family actually helps prolong people staying in foster homes until parents are able to, or keeps adoptive families together. The literature all demonstrates that. This is not a Newfoundland Labrador standard. This is a national standard, and I would say in some cases international standard. So, and the one thing this is what social workers, their primary role there is the assessment of where children stay. So it is a clinical decision on whether a child needs to be removed from a parent or from a foster home and replaced in a place that deems them to be safe. What you need to unpack around all that is that some children have lots of complexities, and and those, you put all the wraparound support you can around them, and unfortunately sometimes you're still going to have tragedy. But the system is designed that way. And I'm not a social worker either, but I've been responsible for the last 3 years, and they're making judgment calls based on their clinical expertise.
Okay. Yep. Here. That's good. One thing that lady, and just the last point on that, she had mentioned that she had ran up her credit to the point there where she never had any more room, waiting for CSSD to reimburse her on, I think, the travel. So I don't know, again, can't talk particular cases, and I would think that you're not aware of any lag in legitimate claims for reimbursing foster parents or foster homes?
So that's
Deputy Minister Duda.
I almost answered the question for you, but I just wondered if you were aware.
No, so I mean, the reality is it's still, so this is one of the items that is actually under review within the department as well, is expedition of payments. So the process now requires, the person in the field or staff member in the office that's responsible for the area and the financial system comes in and is reviewed. And so there may be times when there are delays so I don't want you to think that everything flows out as quickly as possible, because these are not necessarily expenses that are covered under their blocker base amount, but they are things that are extraordinary, so they have the, it has to be brought to the department's attention to be paid. So there may be delays, but those are things that are, you know, staff work diligently to get those paid a period of time. I can't speak to that specific case that I'm not aware of.
Thank you for that.
We are working towards making sure that our payments get out in a timely manner. Sorry.
Yes. I just wanted to ask one question for curiosity. Are you aware of the number of those with disabilities out in our population that were receiving the disability tax credit federally? Like you're going to, everything is based on someone having the disability tax credit. I'm just wondering the department's knowledge of whether people out there have that disability tax credit. Do you know the numbers?
Deputy Minister
Duty. So those numbers can be provided through the Department of Finance. What I can tell you is that when we did the analysis on the disability tax, on the disability benefit for the province, there was at the time approximately 5,000 individuals that would have been eligible for the benefit because they already had a DTC. What's important to note is that those that are don't have income may not have applied for a DTC because they may not necessarily see the benefit of it. So we're expecting that there will be more people come on. As you know, so there's lots of education. So ADM English's team and the Disability Policy Office have been running several sessions with the disability community. There's been lots of uptake on that, and there's resources in place through the federal government to help process the DTC. Yeah.
I'm not sure if the minister and Minister Abbott were there at one where we had Inclusion Canada NL. Mm-hmm. I attended that session. You had to head out for meetings. But one of the stats that was reported there was they looked at the figure that in Newfoundland and Labrador, 65,000 would. That was the number that they had stated. A portion of that number, I think they looked at 30%.
Yeah. You're right. 31% of Newfoundlanders and Labradorians identify
as having a disability.
As having
and
a
whether
disability.
They would meet the criteria for the disability tax credit, that is the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. The but, only thing I wonder.
I got to say this too.
Yeah.
When I was out in my district and getting questions on this, I asked about the DTC and if anybody that had a disability was if they in actual fact had applied for that.
Yeah.
And yes, they have. They already had it. But there's still a fair bit of work to do, and we're doing that diligently, and we have people that are constantly on the phones helping. So.
Yeah. It's awareness as well. That we need to do. Mm. Yep. At a conscious of time, I'm tempted to ask, but I'm not. I'm going to move on from that section.
Okay.
Chair?
Seeing no further questions, I now ask the clerk to recall the subhead.
3.1.01 to 3.1.03 inclusive policy and programs.
Shall 3.1.01 to 3.1.03 inclusive policy and programs carried. All those in favor? All those against? Carried. I ask the clerk to call the next subhead.
4.1.01 to 4.1.03 inclusive prevention and early intervention.
4.1.01 to 4.1.03 inclusive prevention and early intervention. Member for Bonavista.
4.101. Salaries. Can you provide information about which positions have been vacant and for how long? That's giving the salary savings of $800,000.
The savings from the 24-25 budget as a result of vacancies in client services officers' positions during the year. So what we're saying is that there's a turnover. It's the turnover of people moving at all the time. And that's what's causing the
this.
What is the current outstanding balance of overpayments due to income support? And while you're...
The answer to that question would be, from the latest stats we have, is $124 million.
So in the AG's report in 2024, they had the accounts receivable income support overpayments was 111.6 was in that report. And that was a 64% increase since 2019. Okay. What?
I'll ask Alan to respond to that.
Okay. Yeah.
Deputy Minister Doody.
Yeah. So, sorry, I apologize. So so you'll notice there's been a trend of a high increase of overpayments being reflected in the income support overpayments budget. But that's majority of that is a correlation to CERB. Overpayments, so folks that received income support and CERB, and because we've received that data, we've been reconciling with the federal data, and that data has all been reconciled now up to March 31st, 2025. So we're expecting in the next fiscal year, you'll see us return to the increase in overpayments based on historical data, which is more in the time frame of $1 to $2 million a year, so not this big increase, but that's what that's reflecting.
Now, are you sure it's all reconciled up to that?
Yeah, March 31st, 2025. The staff just finished all the reconciliation for all the data that was left provided by the federal government for CERB.
Okay.
So, on the next year, we should start to see that the increase is not so significant as we've seen over the last few years.
Okay. But that's not to say that we don't have income support clients out there that still owe money.
Absolutely. So they're income support clients. We don't take any more than 5% of their income support. So they're cut off from income support or anything like that. We're still providing. Our rule is we take 5% of that back.
Yeah. And needless to say, they can't support. They really can't afford the 5%. Not in a lot of the cases that I'm familiar with. But I know they're going to be paying it for the next several decades, some of them.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. How many households received income support last year?
In 24-25, the average monthly caseload was 20,942 households. The caseload was comprised of 29,213 individuals, 22,192 adults, and 7,021 children under the age of 18.
27,000?
No, 7,021.
Okay, yeah. 7,021 children. Is that trending up from last year? Is it up slightly from last year?
Yeah, I think the individual caseloads may be up a smidgen, but not a whole lot.
Okay. In the allowances and assistance of 4.102 income support program policy,
this one is it. 4.102. Yep.
The allowances breakdown of the $219.6 million by program. Now, would that be on your – would that be listed? And I just wonder if there's anything here in addition to the income support?
So what would be –
That's the allowances and assistance.
Yeah, allowance and assistance, basically what we have is savings from the 24-25 budget is due to the timing in the rollout of new benefits during the year.
The timing and rollout of new benefits.
Yeah.
Okay. And the revenue provincially? The 4.2 million?
Yeah, what we're recovering from individuals that owe us money, is $4,200,000.
Who owes the money?
Who owes?
No, I just wonder. You said money that was owing to the province?
Yes.
From? I'm sorry if I missed that.
Overpayments. It's from overpayments.
From overpayments.
Yep.
That's what was collected back in.
Yep.
Collected through CRA. Would it be a lot of that from the CERB?
Some of that is, it's a mix, right? Clients themselves and other sources that may be deducting.
Okay. Yep. All right. Fair enough. Yep. 4.103, social economic well-being. We know that many advocacy groups and NGOs have established a need for multi-core funding. Has this occurred? And if it hasn't, are we headed in that direction soon?
Yeah, the Department of Finance is now working with all government departments that have grant funding for community organizations. And I think they're determining a process for applications for core funding. So it is being looked at. And I know where that's coming from and the questions around that. And so, you know, they are looking, which is great.
Okay. In salaries here, not sure what positions were vacant or a position were vacant to give the savings of
$136,300, right? Yeah. Yeah. Savings from the 24-25 budget due to vacancies in program and policy development specialist and a supervisor of youth program positions.
And are these being fulfilled now?
Yes, we are in the process of recruiting now.
Okay. All right. And finally, in the grants and subsidies, we had $3.6 million. Can you give an overview of
Yep.
where this money goes?
I can. Yes, I can. Community Youth Network, $2,862,200. Community Sector Council, $206,200. Grants to Youth Organizations, $451,500. Additional unallocated grant funding is $116,000. So our total is $3,636,700.
Just one of your department, and maybe another department, but I know that you got a vested interest in it. The food bank usage, is it staying constant, increasing? Decreasing? Would you have any data related to food bank?
We don't have the data.
No. Anyway, that will conclude my questions, Madam Chair.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, I ask the clerk to recall the subhead.
4.1.01 to 4.1.03 inclusive, prevention and early intervention.
Shall 4.1.01 to 4.1.03 inclusive, Prevention and Early Intervention carried. All those in favor?
Yay.
All those against? Carried.
Total for the Department of Children, Seniors, and Social Development.
Shall the total for the Department of Children, Seniors, and Social Development carry? All those in favor?
Yay.
All those against? Carried. Shall I report the estimates of the Department of Children, Seniors, and Social Development? All those in favor? All those in favor?
Yay.
All those against? Carried. The next meeting will be at the call of the chair. The meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.